You are all very, very welcome to this EBA seminar. In fact, we did expect that we would have a good attendance at this seminar, and it's always pleased when you can announce that you have been oversubscribed. But I hope those that are waiting outside can see that there are some empty seats here and they can come in, and they are welcome. We have very many participants from the whole Swedish civil society, from embassies, and experts of various kinds here. And also we have Ulrika Modér, the State Secretary for Development Cooperation, and you are especially welcome. You will participate later. And of course, I want to welcome the authors of the report that we are going to discuss. That is Andrew Sheriff and Anna Noll. And then we have also members of the reference group here that have followed the work of this group. This is an EBA seminar on one of the most typical issues of our time. Friday last week, some of us attended a most moving event in the Swedish Riksdag, where the mayors of Lampedusa and Lesbos received the Olof Palme Prize for how their small islands, as key hotspots on the refugees from routes from Syria, other countries in West Asia and North Africa, have been beacons of humanity. They have been and are at the forefront of the unprecedented flows of migrants and asylum seekers towards Europe. They have been on the shores with first aid to those who have survived the shaky crossing from Turkey or North Africa. They have also helped rescue passengers from capsizing boats. EU and the EU Frontex have come with some help. Still in the news yesterday about the EU discussion with Libya, it was reported that some, was it right? 5,000 migrants died on the Mediterranean in 2016. Migration has been on the agenda of most EU meetings ever since an already acute humanitarian crisis in the wake of the Syrian war broke out into an accelerating outflow of refugees from the region. Welcome refugees was the slogan that marked an initial response in many civil society quarters in Europe and also from some governments. However, when more than 1 million asylum seekers made their way to and through Europe in 2015, the systems and solidarity collapsed. Attempts to agree on some division of responsibility to accept refugees failed. Of this 160,000 to be relocated from Greece and Italy, only less than 10,000 have to date been accepted in other EU countries. Record numbers of asylum seekers still manage to reach preferred destination countries further north in Europe, with the highest number in Sweden and Germany. Reception systems have become very, very strained, and public opinion and governments swung towards more restrictive attitudes and measures. Sweden, who also in more normal years receive many asylum seekers, has as a practice financed in-country cost during the first year reception from the aid budget in accordance, as it has been claimed, with criteria for reporting of aid expenditure to the DAC. This has always been an issue for debate and criticism from the civil society. It became a very big issue in 2015, also in quantitative terms, in Sweden and in other donor countries as well. The study by Anna Noll and Andrew Sheriff that will be presented here today deals with how four European countries and the Commission have used the aid funds to manage migration challenges. The authors have done a remarkable job in capturing decisions and actions by donors during a turbulent period. They have looked at the financing of in-country reception of refugees. They have also examined how thinking, policies, and measures have evolved in the development cooperation community about the complex relationship between migration and development, as well as about the proper and efficient role of aid in that context. Now, first, some words about EBA. EBA, it's an expert group for aid studies, and it collaborates with researchers and other experts to improve Swedish aid in the long term, and we are a government committee. We collaborate with researchers and other experts, and we analyze and evaluate Swedish international development assistance. We focus primarily on overarching issues with Swedish development assistance. EBA independently defines the issues to be examined and the studies to be commissioned. EBA assesses the quality of the reports before publication, but the authors are solely responsible for analysis and recommendation. But I must say that in this, in all cases, and in this case, we have had a very competent and an active reference group that have read over and over again this long paper and have given comments to the authors. Some of them are here, and Christoph Thomas will, the head of Delmi. He will also comment on the report later. Our ambition is to bridge gap between policy, research, and practice. And in order to disseminate the reports and to sort of get them out into the public and get the attention to them, we arrange seminars like this one. And our goal is simply to contribute to an efficient implementation of well-designed aid. So please, you are welcome. Andrew Sheriff and Anna from, I should say, they come from the European Centre for Migration Policy Management. No, from Development Policy Management. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that introduction. And I'm Andrew Sheriff, and I work for the European Centre for Development Policy Management. We're not yet fully migration experts, but we are continuing to work on it in more detail than we have before. It's very nice to be back in Stockholm. We're here quite often, ECDPM. Sweden is one of our institutional partners. And we're always made to feel welcome, even if often we put challenging analysis on the table. Also, thank you all for coming today. We know that people who focus on migration from doing this research are incredibly busy at the moment. Yet, we cannot escape people's notice that we are in a changing world. And as a think and do tank, and we are a think and do tank, that's what we like to classify ourselves as, we think it's not only important to do in relation to migration, but also to think and think about what we're doing and think about that together with policymakers, civil society, diplomats, and other implementing agencies. It's part of our DNA as ECDPM to use knowledge to facilitate multi-stakeholder dialogue, to put something on the table to discuss that you may or may not agree with, but that captures or tries to capture what is going on. The report has the title Making Waves, and back in 2015, Anna and I were struck that something very significant was happening with migration and with foreign aid. It wasn't just the numbers coming to Europe or DAC OECD figures on in-donor refugee costs or that principles related to development cooperation seem to be under threat or the changing geography of aid and predictability. It was all these things, and they were happening quite rapidly. And what we felt when we looked at the analysis that was out there was that there was a good piece of analysis over here. There was a blog over there. There were some concerns over here. But really trying to pull it together, there wasn't anything that we could find. So we rather, perhaps foolishly, decided, well, maybe we can do something on that. Particularly as civil society and governments were coming to ask us, you know, what is going on? Can you help make sense of that? And this is where EBA came in. We're happy they approached, we were approached by a foreign ministry to do some of this research, not Sweden. We were approached by civil society who also wanted it, but we were looking for an organization that's somewhat separate from civil society or government to support us in this research and an organization that brings experts also to help us frame and do the research. Our background and rationale. Basically, what we're looking at is how change is happening, created by the refugee situation, migration situation, and how it is being responded to in four European countries and the European Commission. I'll talk briefly about why we chose those countries, which was essentially it was about refugee flows and aid flows to those countries. And also, what we discovered, and we did the research over the last year, is that we were trying to research a rapidly moving and evolving target. Things were moving very fast, even throughout the year while we were doing the research. So it is an up-to-date report, only till we finished the research in October 2016, so things have moved on. We would have loved to have the luxury of having an academic report looking back 10 years, but we needed to be policy relevant and quick. Before handing over to Anna on the substance, there is 256 pages in the report, and we have very limited time, so we're not going to cover all the details, so please come back to us. I know Swedes are famed for their fast reading of documents and their devouring of written material and analysis. I know everyone not in the room is Swedes, but please, we have a limited time for the talk. If we don't cover anything, Anna will come back to it. And it may well be in the report. Finally, in an era of fake news and alternative facts and disdain for introducing knowledge and expertise in some parts of the world, we really feel that this multi-stakeholder dialogue is really important on this critical, difficult policy issue. And we hope we make a small contribution to thinking about policy and thinking about practice. But we also rely on you to correct us where we're wrong and carry forward that debate together. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Andrew, and thanks to Ebba for hosting us here. Welcome all to the seminar. I'll go straight into our report. Quickly, an overview of methodology. I won't go too much into detail because you can read it in the report. But what we did was look at extensive desk research. We did literature reviews, looked at a lot of policy documents. And then on the more quantitative analysis, we did go to the OECD DAC ODA database, as well as the national budgets in the years 2015-16. So when I refer to the OECD DAC data, that has been available until 2015 only at the time of research. In addition to that, we did 23 semi-structured telephone and personal interviews specifically for that study, but sort of working on these issues, there's continuously conversations I had and sort of other knowledge and evidence that fed the study as well. Quick outline, I'll jump right into sort of the more short-term responses in the last years that we've seen, changes in ODA usage and priorities. Then I go to the more longer-term issues and the changes in the policy discussions and sort of more the forward-looking plans on how to deal with migration through development cooperation and ODA, and then some considerations for future practices. But as Andrew said, I mean, this is a vast report, and I'm hoping I can sort of outline some issues that we then go more in depth in the panel discussion. So with the unfolding refugee situation in Europe, we've seen ODA has risen, and that is collectively for the EU until 2015, as well as in all the individual case studies that we looked at. EU collectively in euro, it's been increasing from 2014, where it was 59 billion to 68 billion in 2015. When we analyze the 2016 budgets in the national budgets of the case studies, we get a bit more mixed picture, with the Netherlands and Denmark having declining ODA rates, also Netherlands projected in the future actually quite some strong cuts, whereas Germany and Sweden, at least in 2016, have an increase. A trend that has caught headlines and has been mentioned already is these huge increases in donor refugee costs, as we call them. Germany has declared 17% in 2015, up from 1% in 2014, the year before. In Denmark, 15.5% of the ODA was used for hosting refugees within the country, 22% in the Netherlands, and then over 33% in Sweden in 2015. It is a bit lower in 2016 due to sort of the decrease in numbers, but still makes up significant shares of ODA frameworks of donors. Interesting fact is that even if you take off these donor refugee costs, actually ODA has still increased from 2014 to 2015 at least. Collectively for the EU, that has been the case, as well as also in most of the case studies except of Denmark. That means overall, actually, until 2015 at least, more financial support, both sort of for the refugees within European countries, but also additional money for abroad, which in most of the cases, if we look at sort of what that extra money has been used for, was in response to the Syrian refugee crisis. Yet, having said that, there are a number of issues sort of underlying these headline trends that definitely deserve attention. And especially when we also looked at the 2016 national budget, there's been a lot of sort of issues, trade-offs, questions that arise. For one, that is because donors had to deal with quite a large amount of budgetary pressures, especially in that context where refugee flows were quite volatile, and the prediction of how the numbers of refugees that come in are quite difficult to really forecast. I will, before I come to some of the pressures and trade-offs, I want to quickly have one slide on the in-donor refugee issue. As mentioned, there's been a long-standing debate also at the OECD level over the justification of this rule that it's allowed to have, at least for the first year, to declare costs for receiving asylum seekers within Europe also as part of the ODA flows. But it's been agreed that this is part of a development effort to the benefit of developing countries, which guides the overall ODA definition. I think this sort of discussion has been renewed in this context where so huge shares of ODA is declared as this item. And partly this is related to the inconsistency that donors really report this item, which then can also put additional strain on ODA figures that are intended as a comparative measure across countries. So since that rule is interpreted so differently, the questions how much use actually comparing these figures really is. But the OECD is working on that. We found that the higher number of asylum seekers have, of course, contributed to this huge rise in donor refugee costs, but it has not been the only reason. We've seen, for example, in Germany, they have adopted their reporting practices, stating that they wanted to align with sort of the common practice in the OECD. Again, there actually is not a real sort of common interpretation or practice, but they have, for example, included more items in the costs they declare, which partly explains the rise to from 1 to 17%. Similar issues sort of arise in other cases we looked at. Across the case studies, also a lot of controversy about certain items that are reported. In the case of Denmark, for example, activities for job training and sort of more integration of migrants into the economy, which definitely stretched the definition of what is foreseen for this item. And that inclusion throws up sort of questions of efficient use, but also transparency of this item, which is not always very clear where it goes. Issues also sort of for the efficient use of ODA. I mean, some reports of civil society concerns that we looked at was specifically in regards to huge costs for housing and sort of private landlords being paid quite a huge amount, and it's not quite clear how these sort of decisions were being made and whether this was the best use of money. Well, whether justified or not, what did happen is that this put huge pressures on sort of the flexibility and also predictability of aid, in combination with also reacting externally to a situation where there is sort of a lot of humanitarian needs and in the context of addressing sort of the root causes, which has gained prominence. And I'll talk about that a bit later. But in the study, we did also want to understand what type of trade-offs does that really lead to. And that has been specifically prominent in 2015 and 16, sort of when we looked at national budgets. How have donors really dealt with balancing these different demands, and where did these additional costs, where this did money got sourced from, for example, what type of other programs may have received less funding. That is not always easy, because obviously not all money is sort of always being moved or previously committed, but in some instances we could actually say, yeah, there has been clear trade-offs. Sweden and Denmark may be the largest cases here, where there has been trade-offs with sort of the current available funding for development financing. In some cases, sort of cuts of ongoing budget lines for other development cooperation abroad. In the case of the EU Commission and the Netherlands, they have tried to avoid these trade-offs today, but in the case of the Netherlands, for example, the trick has been sort of to bring forward planned development funding for future years, which was tied to the raise in GNI. That effectively means that in the future, the Netherlands will have a cut in ODA, and that is in combination with also political decisions, but this originally envisaged future growth was just brought forward to cover some of the costs today, so the trade-off has been sort of postponed to the future. Similarly, one could say at the European Commission level, they have extensively tapped into the flexibility mechanisms and sort of the margins they had, which right now means in an, for the current budgetary cycle, if there's no increase in these sort of overall lines and or like replenishment of the flexibility mechanisms, there's an implicit assumption that there won't be any new crisis, or if there is, sort of there's not much sort of flexibility room to really deal with it. So, yes, these trade-offs we've seen, and as I said, quite sort of extensively documented in our report. Interesting, maybe another fact to mention, that this humanitarian funding has actually largely been protected from such trade-offs. So in all case studies, we found that humanitarian and immediate relief has been sort of safeguarded and has not been affected. It was more the longer-term programs, and I think donor really tried to balance these demanding pressures and see where, you know, they, if they have to cut, where it would maybe hurt the least. I'll come to some of the longer-term trends or the changing ODA landscape, and also go more into substance of how donors have tried to address migration or are starting to. One aspect is that we can see is maybe not necessarily right now through the numbers beyond sort of the humanitarian geographic focus on clearly the Syrian crisis, is the longer term sort of implication of migration playing a greater role in geographic allocations, and that we've seen in a number of examples. One clear one is the European Trust Fund for Africa, where a lot of sort of money has been drawn from the European Development Fund, which now also includes in the indicators of allocation, includes migration-relevant aspects, such as is a region hosting many migrants, are many migrants coming from there. It's not fully transparent, but at least you can see sort of an inclusion of migration-specific indicators in this list, which previously was not wasn't really there. Similarly, in the Netherlands, we've seen that with specific funds focusing on migration-relevant countries, as well as sort of now, again, sort of the allocation criteria to, or the criteria to choose new key partner countries that the Netherlands has, also including migration relevance. Then in Denmark, also in the new sort of draft strategy, or I think now it is the strategy, at the time of research it was draft, also a focus on focusing specifically on countries that are important from a EU migration dimension, meaning that whether migrants come or whether they host a lot of migrants that potentially could come. Thematically, it's been difficult to really establish a trend with the numbers that we looked at, but we also see shifts in the policy discussions happening on migration. There is a lot of nuance between the countries. So if you read the case studies, I think you'll see it's not sort of easy to summarize all. But I would say generally, and especially at the European level, we see a change from the sort of notion we had in development cooperation linked to migration that was about maximizing the positives of migration, minimizing its challenges from the perspective of developing countries. So a lot of focus actually on south-south mobility in the policy plans, a lot of focus on how does climate change interact, how can we support building of mobility systems within these countries as well to foster mobility. That has changed, at least sort of historically or politically, to addressing root causes and addressing the challenges, a specific focus on how to address the irregular migration situation, how to address smuggling. I'm not saying that these issues were not there before, but we see sort of the shift and an emphasis of focus, as well as on the issue of return. I think one positive aspect that comes out of the debate and what there is definitely more strongly focused on is the aspect of bringing humanitarian funding and development cooperation funding closer together. Again, this discussion has been going on for decades, you could say, but it hasn't really picked up politically. And now some may say because sort of there's this implicit fear that if we don't do this, you know, more migrants could come. But in any case, I think there is much more understanding and movement also on trying to really look at displacement from a development perspective and not only from a humanitarian way. So donors are definitely moving much more on this, but that also brings up a whole lot of other political challenges to meaningfully do that in partner countries. I've already been talking a bit about this. One thing to say, it's very difficult to really transparently find out for what ODA is spent on migration-specific aspects, simply because there's no clear reporting standards, not in the OECD DAC rules, not at the global level. So going through the national data, we could find some trends on what specific migration aspects have donors sort of put more focus on financially, in the case of the Netherlands, for example, more on return, Germany the same. But it's difficult to really establish a good overview. So I think one of the recommendations or sort of maybe way forward is to think about that more strongly and to have more transparency on that, given that this is sort of increasingly a topic that is picked up by donors. I quickly want to talk about some considerations for... Sorry, can I go back? One thing I forgot to, it's an important one to mention, is that approach I mentioned that we've seen also with the EU Trust Fund on the root causes of migration is an interesting one, because thematically, as I said, it's difficult to really find out what that means. We did look a bit at what in policy terms where the emphasis lies, and there is a lot sort of on youth employment, on governance issues, but then we have a whole range of projects ranging from energy to countering radicalization that are suddenly sort of brought under the umbrella of migration and addressing root causes. From our interviews, that does not necessarily mean that there's a meaningful link to migration, especially some interviews pointing out that the early stages of the EU Trust Fund, for example, there were projects that were just sort of there that were already sort of actually part of normal development cooperation, you could say, that have been framed under this. But there is, in the case studies we looked at, also more rethinking of what that actually means. So we may see a shift that in the future that this notion of how to address drivers of migration and more meaningfully integrate migration dimension plays a stronger role and be useful to sort of see what that leads to. There is also in the Trust Fund now with the more recent projects, for example, increased focus on migration governance. And here again, it's more on the focus of addressing the irregular movements, trying to sort of help border governance rather than the general sort of mobility support. That bears risks. I mean, now maybe later in the panel discussion, I think there's sort of twofold implication. with also in context of the Agenda 2030 integrating a notion of migration, is that this increased focus on it has opportunities to actually meaningfully do that and integrate migration mobility patterns, how it links to development processes from the context of the people, from the context of the developing countries. But the big risk, and I think we're tending to sort of go towards that route more, is that there is a lot of sort of EU-focused and concerns on what type of specific outcome we want to have with that, which relates, for some people that I talk to, relates, yes, to reducing the migration flows and stopping the numbers. For others, again, it's a bit more unclear. It's more about the development dimension, but there seems no clarity what we want to sort of really achieve with it. Neither is there good frameworks on the what success would look like and what how we could actually monitor success. One example is the example of reintegration. There's not clear standards of when a person is actually really fully reintegrated. So if you put a lot of money into reintegration and you don't actually know what you want to achieve, that that may be another sort of way forward to think more carefully about these strategic aspects and the frameworks of monitoring success. Yes, I come to the end. So I've already covered two, the clarity on OECD DAC guidelines for Indian refugee costs, which are currently discussed and I think is important because it has huge impact on what funding is available. Building on the contextual knowledge and culture of monitoring and evaluation, a point I forgot to say, which is important also for the discussion, is that this risk of trying too much to address irregular migration and reduce flows is that we know from the migration and development nexus that it is a livelihood strategy for many people, and sort of the strong focus on reducing flows may actually not help the process of people gaining livelihoods and trap them even in situations that become more destitute. So that is something to keep in mind, what type of starting point you actually have. And then in the context of the UN Global Compact, there are similar discussions ongoing. So I think you can link that very much to having exchange on these standards, on return, on reintegration, on guidelines, how to sort of best do that and discuss best practices for these development focused projects or migration projects that we will probably see more and more coming from a lot of donors in Europe. So I'll stop here, and I hope we will continue the discussion on all these various different topics. And I will thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much. There will be time later to put clarifying questions when we have the panel. The audience will be able to put questions also and comments. Because it's a lot to digest, but thank you very much for the presentation.